Blog Talk Radio.
I hate you both. I've hated you ever since I can remember. I hate you, and I wish you both had cancer.
Cancer?
Yes, in the head.
I'm as tired as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
Are you telling me you built a time machine? Out of a DeLorean?
That's hot.
Hello there, children.
Hey, kids.
People seem to like me because I am polite and I'm rarely late.
And now the host of the Stupid Cancer Show, Matthew Zachary.
Monday, June 22nd, and we are once again live on the Stupid Cancer Show. The voice of young adults affected by cancer, we are your friendly neighborhood weekly social webcast, finally giving that voice to more than 5 million young adults affected by cancer. This broadcast is a program of the I'm Too Young for This Cancer Foundation, a national leader in the fight against cancer, working exclusively on behalf of survivors and their care providers under the age of 40. Got cancer under 40? Sucks, huh? Well, get busy living, because the Stupid Cancer Show is on the air. Welcome to tonight's broadcast, my friends. We are here to change the world, one chemo infusion at a time, and share all of our collective correctness. Now call me a hippie, but do not call me a victim, because I don't believe that change is possible if we never disrupt and challenge the status quo. I am still here, and you are still here. This is why we fight. Forget the cure, folks. That's right, you heard it here first. Forget the cure. Survivorship is all that matters. So welcome, my friends, to yet another Stupid Cancer Movement moment, because we're here to stay in the couches comfy. Here in Stupid Cancer Land, we're not just about the quantity of your life, we're about the quality, too. Why? Because there's more to the cure than just research. The need to cure cancer for Gen X and Gen Y, whatever that winds up meaning, is only going to come from within our own ranks. Are we on our own? Well, as I always say, we are the generation that invented Google, Facebook, Twitter, and kept Sanjaya on American Idol all those weeks. We should be able to take care of our own, friends. This is Generation Cancer, and it is our fight. We have the sheer numbers, the voting power, and the influence to change the rules. Because remission is not an excuse for a cure, and survivorship is all that matters. Last week's show, Delayed Diagnosis Sucks, with Survivor Spotlight Astrid DeCastri, and pairing up Glenn Rockowitz and Brandon Hayes Latin. Glenn is the author of Rodeo and Juliet, a four-time young adult survivor and one of the most cynically fantastic men I've ever had the privilege of having on the show. And Brandon, of course, is our resident rock star young adult oncologist survivor from Oregon Health and Science University. Tonight's show is called All Young Adult Diseases Suck. Because quite honestly, it ain't just about cancer. If you're in your 20s, 30s, and get struck with something catastrophic or chronic, it still sucks. Joining us tonight, live in the studio, will be Yosef Eliezeri in our Survivor Spotlight. And first guest, Amy Kendridge, freelance writer, healthcare blogger, great friend, amazing, amazing woman, founder of a great organization and a website called Diabetes Mine. And Adam Sadowski, entrepreneur, IBD patient, and founder of the IBD Support Foundation. We'll be checking in with us a little later. So hello, my friends, and welcome to yet another fun-filled and exciting romp through the hay on tonight's Stupid Cancer Show, and a Stupid Cancer welcome to all of our first-time listeners here on the Blog Talk Radio Network, especially our new friends who we met in Washington, D.C. at last week's Jonna's Body event with the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. So anyway, coming at you live from the Chemo Deck, our fabulous studio in downtown Manhattan, I'm your host, Matthew Zachary, 13-year young adult brain cancer survivor. Joining me live in the studio tonight, our chief cancer anarchist, Jack Raffart. Hello, Jack. What's up, buddy? Jack will be monitoring our live concurrent interactive chat room, so if you have something to say, well, I might ignore you. He won't. and he'll be live and engaging everyone in the chat room, trying to make sure that they actually have real guest logins instead of just guest logins.
We got a lot of new guests in here.
A lot of guests tonight. And as always, it is my and Jack's esteemed pleasure to introduce the official partner in crime here on the Stupid Cancer Show, hailing from the Windy City of Chicago, fellow young adult survivor and author of the acclaimed book, which everyone needs to go pick up a copy of, Everything Changes, The Insider's Guide to Cancer in Your 20s and 30s, the lovely, talented, blocktastic, and spectacular Carol Rosenthal.
Hello, Matthew.
Hello, Carol. How are you?
Hi, Carol.
Hey, Jack.
How are you
doing? I'm good.
We have a live studio audience tonight as well. I'd like to introduce first Eric Charsky. Say hello, Eric.
Hello.
Eric hails from, where are you, from Gainesville?
Yes.
And you are a colon cancer survivor?
Correct.
And you are Johnny Immerman's stunt double?
Yes.
Okay, great. And joining Eric is?
Tess.
And Tess is also from Gainesville?
Yes.
And she is on the Charsky tour of the Northeast of the United States?
Correct.
Okay, great. Also a sort of the New York City staple member here, Lisa Wolf. Welcome, Lisa.
Hey, guys.
And, of course,
hi,
our
Lisa.
Survivor Spotlight is here in advance. We'll be getting to him in a minute. Yosef Eliezeri, say hello.
Hey, guys.
You're supposed to say shalom.
Shalom.
There we go. Much better. Okay.
Irish?
That's Irish, yes. All right, so what's going on, Carol? How you been?
I've been really good. I had a really spectacular day today. I made this incredible connection. Well, there's this woman who I've been connecting with recently. She is a widow of this fantastic guy who is in my book, and she wrote this piece on my blog today that kicked ass about reclaiming the word widow. She went onto MySpace, and she was changing her status, and she realized there's no friggin' widow. You know, you're like single or married or divorced, but there's no widow on MySpace. And it just kicked her off into writing this really eloquent piece about what it means to be a widow and what life is all about when you're dealing with grief. And it's just so like raw and real and not dramatic or tragic, but just very like upfront and spectacular. And it's, yeah, she's completely rocking my world and made me have a great day.
Awesome. That's pretty cool. But one of those small things you never really think about, is it?
Well, it's something I think we need to think about more because, you know, I think about how many people don't make it in our age range, and they've got loved ones, whether it's like a girlfriend, boyfriend, best friend, whatever. And so I think it's something that we need to talk a lot more about in this community. I mean, I completely understand why we shy away from thinking about it when we're trying to focus on our own recovery and making it through, but I just think that there are so many opportunities for us to join together and support other people who are really going through this hard time and still need the support of our community. So I think we should be talking about this a lot more.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that the big hot topic of the day, though, is the legislation Obama signed on the White House Rose Garden today. Did you watch
Indeed
that?
Indeed it is. Do you think he's going to quit taking the secret puffs out on the White House lawn now?
I
think he kind of has to.
I think, yeah, I mean, if he's caught in public smoking one more time, I think it's going to be the end of him.
Yeah, yeah, it's really, really quite historic and amazing what happened with that legislation.
But let me ask you this question. I'll always play the cynic advocate here in the sense Dennis Leary did a bit a couple of years ago called No Cure for Cancer. It was a brilliant, like, stand-up routine. And he goes off on cigarettes, and he talks about how people that smoke are always going to smoke, that you could label You could basically put cigarettes in a black box and label it tumors, and people would still buy it.
That's true.
Is the only way to really cut people's use of smoking, is it really the marketing that's getting them? Is it the peer pressure, or is it the fact that it's just,
the tumors are so sexy and everybody wants them?
No, but, I mean, we're on the other side of that equation. And I actually have a public service announcement to read later from St. Jude's about how young adults I'll read the first sentence here. We'll get to it in a minute. 18% of adults who survived cancer as children smoke cigarettes. You know, and we have to think about that. Like, what really compels people to start smoking in the first place? And obviously, outside of cost prohibition, if they make it like $500 a pack, people won't. It'll go black market.
Yeah,
well,
it's like moonshine in the prohibition days.
Right.
Well, I mean, I think part of their legislation that's really important is that this marketing and changes in marketing will hopefully prevent people from starting to smoke in the first place, like not having strawberry Kool-Aid flavored cigarettes, you know.
Yes.
No more Hawaiian punch guy on like your pack of smoke.
Oh yeah.
So, you know, I think that's important. And I mean, I also think it's important to recognize that there are people who quit smoking, that 90% of people who quit smoking successfully do it by going cold turkey. And I don't exactly know what it is that works for them, because I actually used to smoke a little bit here and there, but I was never a smoker. I was just one of those like cool intellectual smokers when I went to like Columbia University and hung out in the, what is it called, the Hungarian pastry shop. You had to have Camel cigarettes then. You couldn't,
right.
You couldn't walk in the door without smoking. So I used to smoke a little, but I've never had to, you know, quit smoking. And so I don't know. I mean, I think it's really important. I think another thing that's so important about smoking is not just the cancer factor, but the heart disease factor,
right?
Which is huge, and I think impacts us directly, because say we're neutropenic and we need to get our ass rushed in an ambulance to the ER, well, we can't get a bed in the ER because somebody else is in there having their little smoker-related heart disease incident. I'm like, screw you, get out of my bed. You know, you could control this by not smoking.
But do you have any, I plead complete ignorance to all the statistics in this. I really haven't done any homework on it, but has it been shown that our generation, like the boomers' children, the Gen Xers, do we smoke less than our parents by and large?
I don't have that statistic either. We should look that up.
Yeah, I mean, I'd just be interested in knowing, because we're a somewhat more conscious generation. We're a somewhat more green, perhaps, generation.
Yeah,
do we actually smoke less?
I think overall smoking rates have decreased, but I'm just totally pulling that out of my ass. Or some vague memory of some great statistic that I read, but I don't have enough brain cells left to retain the information.
I guess from my perspective, I think it's phenomenal that the government, that this is something where we need regulation and government control over. But at the same time, you know, what hasn't made it work in the last, you know, 30 years, that teen smoking might be up. If it is, if it isn't, I don't know the answers to those statistics. But, you know, is making half the packet say this will kill you really going to dissuade people from buying it outside of it being $50 a pack? Because alcohol's, you know, the other major elephant in the room substance that's not really regulated in this country, and it's responsible for many more deaths, you know, in terms of like substance abuse, right? With like drunk driving and
mm-hmm.
spousal abuse or whatever is out there. I'm making this up too, out of my ass. It's talk out of your ass night. Tonight, folks.
Talk out of our ass. Well, let's have facts and figures night next week, and
okay.
We'll just have talk out of
we'll
our
come
ass
back with facts and figures night.
Yeah, well, one thing about cigarettes is, and I always found this quote to be very intriguing, but cigarettes are the only product out there that, when used as directed, will kill you. And it's true. I mean, and the other thing is, because, you know, being from Connecticut, we get these pretty cold winters. Not as bad as you get out in Chicago, Carol, but you know, when I'm out at bars, and, you know, Connecticut is one of the states that are smoke-free, there's still people that will go out on, like, a bitter cold night to smoke their cigarettes and then come back in and then complain about how cold it is. And I'm just like, well, what the hell? Like, you're going out in the bitter cold to kill yourself.
Well, you know,
I just don't get
in terms of being used, you know, if used correctly, there's the Play School Splash and Laugh Bathtub Hair Blower. Have you heard about this?
I have one.
Yeah. Oh, you have one? Okay.
Yeah.
You're obviously not using it as directed, but you're still alive.
My slip and slide, I didn't use as directed because I forgot to put water on it.
Right. We're going to have to patent that. The Play School Laugh and Laugh. Oh, wait. Splash and Laugh Hair Blower. That's what we have to call it. Yeah. Okay.
Sounds good.
Fabulous. So, we saw Doug Ullman was in the crowd at the White House today. We saw his forehead poking out above the other people there. And he was twit-picking away as par for the course. We expect nothing less from Doug, but it was great to know that he was there.
Yeah, we saw Doug taking his phone out on CNN, and then we were like, wait for it, boom, tweet from Doug, here's a picture.
Yeah.
All right, here's a stat. I'm sorry, I really...
Oh, you've been working assiduously while we're making fun of Jack? Okay, great.
I did, thank you. Thank you for killing the time. In 2007, 20% of high school students reported smoking in the last 30 days, down 45% from 36.4% in 1997, when rates peaked after increasing throughout the first half of the 1990s. So they went up in the early 90s, and then they went down.
Man, what happened in the 90s that would have sparked that? We go with, like, big hair, or was that the 80s?
No, that was the 80s.
Zeke Avaricius was the
80s.
Tamagotchi. What happened in the 90s? Tamagotchi.
I was smoking
Nirvana,
too much pot. I can't remember.
Furbies. Or it's the Furbies. Furbies made everyone smoke cigarettes because you wanted to kill yourself when you had a Furby.
Yeah. Skinny, candy-flavored cigarettes.
Well, did you have those gummy cigarettes with the flour out? And
you would blow on them.
You could puff them and they blew flour out?
Yeah. Yeah, I doubt they make those anymore. It was like the powdered sugar in the
powdered sugar candy cigarettes, yeah.
Yeah.
I love those. The first time I smoked a cigarette was when I was in sixth grade when my cousin was babysitting me. She was supposed to be a good influence on me. This is why my parents had her come babysit me. And she was like, hey, let me teach you how to smoke a cigarette. So, you know, it was fun.
Interesting.
Crazy kids.
There's always going to be an allure.
You know what kills me about this day and age? Like, it's 2009, and in some parts of the country, they still have smoking in restaurants and smoking in public buildings. And, you know, they bring up the legislation to ban the smoking, and people vote against it. It's like, you know, there's some states I walk into to get something to eat, and they're like, smoking or non. And I'm like, what? Smoking or non? Like, what is this, 1986?
Yeah, exactly. I remember growing up, we had a local diner that made like a blocked-off section of the restaurant just for smokers, and they encase it like a bank vault with like this translucent, you know.
Like some of the airports have their smoking lounges?
Well, it was like a see-through bank vault that you could see all the people in this section were smoking, and the entire cube, which I don't know if they even actually put the air conditioning ventilation system in there, was just full of smoke. You could barely even see the people that were eating in the cancer cube, I guess we could call it that. So, all right, well, I guess in terms of in the long term, yeah, I'm really happy they passed a bill that regulates the tobacco company more than ever before. I think that's definitely a good thing to do. It can't hurt, and I would fall over backwards to see a pack of cigarettes that say tumors on them.
Well, how often have you seen somebody wearing a little yellow Livestrong bracelet and smoking a cigarette? I see it all the time.
I saw one at the Livestrong Summit.
Yes, he did.
There were a thousand delegates at the Livestrong Summit, and I found the one that smoked.
Yep.
Excellent. I always ask someone, whenever I see somebody smoking with a yellow Livestrong bracelet, I ask them about it. You know, I try to do it in a polite way so that if they're going to punch me, it doesn't hurt too much. Yeah, strike up some good conversations.
All right, well, I'm putting a challenge out to all of our listeners. If you find someone wearing a Livestrong wristband that is smoking, take their picture with your camera phone and email it to us at stupidcancer@icy.com.
Excellent. We can have a whole gallery.
And we'll send you a stupidcancer.com bracelet picture.
Yeah, we'll send you a bracelet or a pin of your choice if you email us pictures of Livestrong bracelet wearing smokers.
And that doesn't mean stage a photo with your friend that smokes.
Right.
Don't hand them your Livestrong bracelet because I'll find you and I will call you out for the fraud that you are.
Yes.
It could be the hypocrite's gallery.
Exactly.
So, you know, there's a woman who I interviewed in my book in Alabama who's amazing, and she's a total smoker, and she had major brain cancer. She had, like, you know, an extremely small percentage chance of living. She was like the one person in all 98 people on her clinical trial who didn't die, and she still smokes. And she was like, you know, this is the most stressful thing that I've gone through in my life. I know that I should quit, but holy cow, like I need something, you know, to deal with this potential death thing. It's scary as hell. And, you know, sitting next to her and talking and looking at what her life has been like, it's hard for me to blame her.
Well, I suppose so. What's that?
I was just asking if we were going to talk about Jonna's body and how awesome it was.
Well, let's do that we'll finish up the news, and then we'll talk about Jonna's body, and then we can, which sounds really disgusting, but it's actually a play called Jonna's Body, and then we can get to Yosef. That sound good?
That sounds good.
All right, so let me cue up the news for Jack, who is going to read the stupid cancer news. Where the hell is it?
It's in my hand.
I got it.
Hello, I'm Kent Brockman, and this is Eye on Cancer.
Just the facts, ma'am.
Okay, during this part of the Stupid Cancer Show, we announce worthy news stories to our adoring listeners to inform them about the latest and greatest in young adult programs, services, events, projects, and other stuff. If you or your organization have an upcoming program, service, event, project, or other stuff that you would like to hear broadcast during this segment, please fax it to us at 646-861-2565 or send Jack Buford an email at jack@i2y.com. Let me read the first announcement here, Jack, because I think this is just ties right into
where
we're
talking. Go for it,
dude. All right, this is directly from St. Jude's, and I think everyone's going to have a shit fit when they hear this. 18% of adults who survived cancer as children smoke cigarettes. I'll say that again. 18% of adults who survived cancer as children smoke cigarettes. WTF is right in the chat room.
What?
A new program from St. Jude's is helping childhood cancer survivors break the habit because apparently common sense isn't working. The Tobacco Quitline Study is a free and open program to survivors 18 and older who smoke. Participants receive up to 6 free counseling sessions as well as free nicotine replacement therapy. To learn more, call 877-4SJ-QUIT, as in 4 St. Jude's Quit, or visit stjude.org. Break free from smoking. I'm ready to throw open my mouth at those statistics. All right, Jack, it's up to you. Go ahead.
Thanks, pal. Here we go, folks, your stupid cancer news. Thursday, June 25th, from 7:30 to 10 at Bloom Saloon in San Francisco, we have a Stupid Cancer Happy Hour. Join Stupid Cancer San Francisco's meetup group for a happy hour at Bloom Saloon, 7:30 to 10 on June 25th. That's actually Wednesday, I'm sorry, not Thursday. It is Thursday. Friday the 26th in Long Island, we have Stupid Cancer Sports Night from 7 to 11 at Dave & Buster's on Veterans Highway in Isola, New York. Join Stupid Cancer Long Island as they present their Stupid Cancer Sports Night at Dave & Buster's from 7 to 11 this Friday night. Our friends at Can't Make a Dream are running their young adult conference as we speak. Upcoming Make a Dream camps are July 1st through the 8th, their teen camp from July 12th through the 19th, their kids camp from July 23rd through the 30th is their siblings camp, and their heads up conference for survivors ages 18 to 25 is in August. For this and all of Can't Make a Dream information, please refer to www.campdream.org. That's campdream.org. First Ascents 2009 program schedule, kayaking, mountain climbing, and camping, June 26th through the 2nd in White Lake, Wisconsin, July 5th through the 11th, July 12th through the 18th, and July 19th through the 25th at Glacier National Park in Montana. July 17th through the 23rd is White Sandbing, Washington. That is their Pacific Northwest First Ascent, and I will be there. July 24th through the 30th in Vail, Colorado, and July 31st through August 6th in Vail, Colorado. August 14th through the 20th in Garden City, Idaho. And finally, August 30th through September 4th in Jackson, Wyoming. You can read about these and all First Ascent programs at firstdescent.org. That's firstdescent.org. Cancer sucks. It really, really sucks. Cancer sucks.
What is that?
It really, really sucks. Well, it's actually Water Sucks from the Water Boy.
Oh,
remember
right,
the Water Boy?
Okay, yes.
CancerReallySucks.org is a teen website sponsored by the nonprofit organization Gems of Hope Incorporated with a mission of bringing hope to cancer patients and their families. www.CancerReallySucks.org was designed by teens for teens. This site offers strategies on how to deal with a cancer diagnosis in the family and much more. An open chat line is held on the first and third Wednesday of the month from 10 to 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Check it out at CancerReallySucks.org. Everything Changes, the Insider's Guide to Cancer in Your 20s and 30s, is the newly released book written by our very own Stupid Cancer co-host, Carol Rosenthal. Everything Changes dusts the sugarcoating off of the young adult cancer experience. It is packed with gripping stories and an unprecedented collection of young adult cancer resources. Everything Changes is available wherever books are sold, and you can visit the website for the book, everythingchangesbook.com. Next up, we have 70k.org. That's the word 70, the letter K.org. There are approximately 70,000 people aged 15 to 39 diagnosed with cancer every year. For over two decades, there has been little or no improvement in survival for this age group. By signing this bill, you are supporting the Adolescent and Young Adult Cancer Bill of Rights to be established as a standard for care to meet the needs of this underserved population. Moving on to cancer care programs. The young adult groups that are active and running at cancer care are as follows. Living with cancer, for those in active treatment. Life after cancer, post-treatment. Young adults lost of a parent. Young women with breast cancer. Young adult individual grief counseling. And young adult caregiver for all diagnoses and relationships. Contact I2Y friend Julie Larson at jlarson@cancercare.org. That's J-L-A-R-S-O-N @cancercare.org. Or you can reach Julie by phone at area code 212-712-6173. And finally, we have Live On, sperm banking by mail for cancer patients. Trust me, guys, do not do what Eric Charsky did. Mailing sperm without a Live On kit is frowned on by our federal government. For more information on sperm banking by mail, please refer to www.liveonkit.com. LiveOnKit.com. Live sperm banking by mail is made possible by our good friends at Fertile Hope, and Eric wanted me to send a personal thank you to the law firm of Dewey, Scroom & Howe for clearing up his embarrassing situation with the United States Postal Service. That, my friends, is your stupid cancer news, and back to you, Matthew.
Oh, my goodness. All righty. Oh, boy. All right, so let's move on after that disgraceful piece of information from Jack.
It's okay, Eric. I'm sure you're not the only one who's done that. Okay.
You know, it was a mistake, but we all make them, right?
Guests are not allowed to talk. What's that line from? What's that line from the Pink Floyd movie on the Wall?
Well, the Wall was their movie.
Oh, never mind. My brain didn't work right there. All right, here we go. What time is it? All right, in our Survivor Spotlight tonight, Yosef Eliezer, a 2.5-year young adult leukemia survivor diagnosed at age 19 with AML, underwent 5 rounds of chemo, into remission in April of 06, relapsed in August of 06, had a bone marrow transplant from an unrelated donor in October of 06, and is currently, 2.5 years later, in remission. He recently received his rabbinical ordination and is interning at Chabad.org, the largest Jewish website in the world. And he is a member of the Young Adult Leadership Council, one of my favorite Orthodox Jews. I only know one, so they're absolutely my favorite. Please welcome to the Stupid Cancer Show, Yosef Eliezer.
Hey, Matt.
Live in the chemo deck.
Hey, hey.
How are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing very well.
It's really, really nice to have you here.
Finally.
So, you were, as I just go through puberty, apparently, a patient of Dr. Leonard Sanders, the chairman of I2Y.
Yeah, I was a patient of Dr. Sanders.
You all right?
I'm fine.
You have to talk into the microphone. Stop looking at me because you can't see me through the monitor. Okay, that's much better. See? Okay. Dr. Leonard Sender is a South African Jew. How did you tolerate his accent?
He's a lot of fun.
Okay. That's I'll accept that at the bare minimum. So there's been a lot of articles written about you as a young adult Orthodox Jew going through this. You've been on the front page of, like, pretty much more media than I have. Lenny sends me something about you probably every week. So what do you think, like, you were 19 when you were diagnosed. Were you in school at the time?
Yeah, I was in school, in rabbinical school. I just finished my third or fourth year, and I had 2 years to go.
So this kind of put a bit of a stopgap into that whole...
Put a stopgap in everything.
Yep. And what was it like to relapse? And then, I mean... I don't mean that like really, but like you went through this and out of the woods, and we talk about cure, but whatever, and you know, then you relapsed. You talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, for me, actually, relapse was much more difficult than the actual getting cancer, because when I got it, I was so sick that I barely remember the first few days. After 48 hours after I got diagnosed, I was in a coma for 8 days. So for me, relapsing was much more difficult. But at that point, I also had a lot more support and a lot more friends that were helping me out and other things.
And you were in Orange County, right?
Yes.
At the time, so you were completely swapped with an amazing community from what I hear.
Yeah, they're really an amazing community in Orange County.
Lenny tells me that there were 4 million people in Orange County, and he treats 95% of all the young adult survivors there. Did you meet a lot of other young adults while you were there?
I did meet a bunch of other young adults while I was in treatment. I helped a bunch of them. There was one individual I remember who was having an impossibly hard time going through treatment, and the team came up to me and asked me to help him out, and actually got him through treatment, and he's now in remission and starting a new life. So that was...
Well, you were giving back while you were still in the midst of it.
Yep.
That's pretty impressive stuff.
I have a question for you.
Go ahead, Carol.
I'm curious to know if when you were in rabbinical school, you had to do CPE credits, clinical pastoral education credit.
No.
No.
Not.
Uh-huh. Well, then forget my question. Forget my question. I know a lot.
Oh. Did we lose Carol?
Can you hear me now?
Oh, there you are.
Yeah.
You got a call waiting or something?
Nope. I don't know what that little blip was.
Gremlin.
Well, all right, then let me rephrase my question. I'm curious about how your personal experiences with cancer may or may not play into the role of your profession and how you work with other people.
What do you mean profession, as a rabbi or as a...
Yeah.
Well, I sort of got brought up trying to help people, like,
mm-hmm.
my whole life. My father was a rabbi. We have a large community, and, you know, I've been doing outreach since I was a little kid. So it was really nice, actually, to see, like, the community give back to us, my family and I, and they really were amazingly supportive. I mean, so much so that for the first few weeks, I had something like 20 visitors a day. The hospital
wow.
didn't even want to let them all in. And from a spiritual thing, I think that my training as a rabbi and all the my mental mental the point where I was mentally really helped me get through everything.
So let me ask you then, I mean, well, all of this, you know, what does the word survivor mean to you at this point? You're out 2.5 years now. You know, it means something different to everybody. We always like to ask our young adult community, or, like, what does it mean to you?
For me, survivor means reaching your dreams, going for your dreams. I had a lot of things going on when I was first diagnosed, and I could not do much during my treatment. So for me, survivorship is really about going back to what I really wanted to do and sort of readdressing all my dreams. A lot of things have changed. My real perspective has extremely changed. But really, it's survivorship for me is about going after your dreams in life.
And you are doing that. You went back to rabbinical school and you just got ordained. Or
mm-hmm.
what was it? You got... Were you ordained?
I got ordained.
You did?
I am an ordained rabbi.
So you can actually marry people, like, right now?
Yeah.
Because Jack's been staring at Eric. And they're both not Jewish, so it still counts, right?
I'll have to get back to you on that.
Okay.
Not like
enough.
The two negatives equal positive.
Very nice. Well, one of the questions that actually Carol came up with this, I think is really important. We talk about the happy side of cancer and everything successful, but what was your crappiest moment? When did shit just really hit the fan for you?
For me, my crappiest moment was when I relapsed. I had I had seen the doctor on a Friday, and Dr. Sender told me that he saw something in my labs that didn't look right, and said, come back Monday. And if the labs aren't good, you need a bone marrow biopsy. So on Monday, I came back, I got my lab, and within an hour, they called me back, said, come in for a bone marrow biopsy. They put me to sleep for the biopsy because it's a painful procedure. And when I woke up, my mother was laying in the floor, passed out from shock. And at that point, I knew that I had relapsed. And for me, that was, I think, the worst moment. Because I didn't know if I had a bone marrow donor or not. I didn't know what the treatment would be. And for me, that was just the worst moment. But actually, the best moment was actually the very next day when I found out I did have a donor.
Wow. And how did you find this donor again?
Through the International Registry.
Now, I mean, I know that with, like, a lot of the Jehovah's Witnesses, they can't take donor blood or donor stem cells or donor marrow from, you know, specific religions. Did that play a part for you?
Not at all. My donor and his sisters actually volunteered a year or two earlier before they started searching, and somehow it didn't end up popping in the registry till a few months before I relapsed.
Wow. All right, our next question is just going to throw away. Who would win in a cage match, Lance Armstrong versus Melissa Etheridge?
Lance Armstrong.
Okay, fair enough. If your cancer story had a bumper sticker, what would it say and why? Dude, we gave you these questions like a week ago. Yeah, you should have an answer.
If my cancer story had a... Cancer sucks. Screwed up my life, but life's about dreams, so cancer really gave me all my dreams. So. Yeah.
And last question, what is the most important thing that needs to happen to improve life for young adult survivors?
In my opinion, it's better health care coverage and better treatment plans for young adults.
I paid him to say that.
I'm sure you did. You channeled some Hebe right through the internet.
Did you notice that I haven't brought up health care coverage once this entire show yet? I was just waiting for that moment. I was waiting for him
to
say
Amy,
that.
Well, Amy, we're going to talk to Amy in a minute, and, you know, she's diabetes. You know, like, that's crazy health care issues. So we're going to – you'll get your fix, Carol, I promise.
Excellent.
And you're busting at the gut there to get that out. All right, well, Yosef, thank you for being on the Stupid Cancer Show.
Thank you.
You're going to stick around in the chat room here.
I am.
Which is always good to have you here. And I don't know if this is the right... I queued this up on YouTube. I don't think this might see if this works. Mm.
Woo-hoo!
That was just for you, man, all right? See how special you are?
Thanks, Matt.
Okay, my pleasure.
I haven't heard that song since St. Patrick's Day.
All righty, what song should we pick for her? Let's pick, let's do this song. Okay, my first guest tonight is a journalist, a patient blogger, who started DiabetesMine.com after her diagnosis of type 1 diabetes 5 years ago. Her site has become a leading online destination for people with diabetes around the country and the world, and one of the leading health blogs overall. In 2006, she won the Lilly for Life Achievement Award for Diabetes Journalism from Eli Lilly and Company, and has become not just a personal friend of mine and a supporter of I2Y, but an extremely well-known advocate for all people with diabetes and all empowered e-patients. My pleasure and privilege to welcome to the Stupid Cancer Show, Amy Tenderish. Please, Amy, how you doing?
Doing well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Welcome. Oh, it's so great to have you here. I've known you almost like 3 years now, and you're like an idol. I love you. I love everything you do, and you're one of the real winners in the Health 2.0 social movement by doing what you've done. And it's a real model to be followed after. So congratulations.
Oh, thank you. I'm listening to Yosef, and I'm thinking, oh my God. You people are amazing. And okay, I don't know if this counts. I'm not a rabbi, but I am a Jew with a chronic illness. Does that count?
Well, the theme of today's show is that all chronic diseases for young adults suck, no matter what it is.
It's true. It's true.
So I know Carol has a bunch of questions, but just talk us through, how old are you when you're diagnosed with type 1 diabetes? And I claim to be ignorant about the disease as well, but, like, what are the symptoms? Is there, like, detection? How does it all happen? Yeah.
Sure. So I guess I still sort of count in the young adult group because I was 37 when I was diagnosed. And the really funky thing about getting type 1 diabetes when you're over 20 is that people think you're some kind of freakazoid. You know, it was traditionally known as a juvenile illness that struck children. And to this day, many hospitals and clinics are very unfamiliar with what is now called LADA, which is latent autoimmune diabetes in adults. So I have sort of become the poster child for people who get diagnosed with type 1 diabetes later in life, but it's not as uncommon as you might think. It's just that in the old days, if you presented with diabetes over a certain age, they just stamped you as a type 2, which also meant they didn't treat you properly. So it was a problem in many ways. And I had the experience that the doctors and nurses who dealt with me initially didn't know what to do with me, which made my first couple of years just a miserable mess of hypoglycemia, which is low blood sugars all the time, just taking way too much insulin. So the thing about type 1 diabetes versus type 2 is that type 1 is an autoimmune disease. It has nothing to do with eating too many sweets or your diet at all. In fact, most type 1s are thin, fit people. Basically, your immune system attacks the pancreas and kills off the cells that create insulin. So you, in order to sustain life, you have to take insulin, and it has to be delivered by injection. It cannot be taken orally. They're trying to figure that out, but it so far doesn't work. So it has to be delivered by injection, and it also means that for the rest of your life, every morsel that goes in your mouth and every action that you take, every time you go for a walk instead of taking a bus, you know, you need to think really hard about that, and you need to monitor your sugar constantly and, you know, take the right amount of insulin and have sugar on hand just in case you get too low. And, you know, if it's not in good control, it can be a huge, huge mess. And, you know, we're talking passing out behind the wheel of cars, killing people, killing yourself. So, you know, it's just something that you don't go any 20 minutes in your life without thinking about. It's just a very intense disease because you have to manage it constantly. So that was just, as you can imagine, an enormous change in life for me, having lived 37 years of my life without having to deal with this, and then suddenly being hit with this thing that just seemed like it came out of left field, and not being able to find people who were really familiar with it and able to help me.
I think it's so great to talk to you, and that we're, you know, this is a cancer show and we're talking about diabetes here. And I think that there's so much that we can learn from people our age who are living with different diseases. And I'm really curious about what some of the stereotypes are around what a diabetes patient is. Because I know that people certainly, when they find out that I have cancer, you know, I can remember this one woman who, I was just filling out some paperwork somewhere, and she found out I had cancer, and she was like, oh my God, you are so inspirational, you're such a fighter, I can't believe what a strong fighter you are. And I'm like, yeah, I'm a fighter, and that I might kick your ass if you keep stereotyping me like this. But, you know, like, people
wouldn't believe the things people say about diabetes.
Yeah, I find that people think that you're, you know, so inspirational just because you've had cancer. And I'm wondering if there's a similar stereotype about diabetes, or if there are any, what the stereotypes are about people who have diabetes.
Oh, I could talk to you all day about that. But let's start with where you began, which is when people tell me, oh, you test your sugar, you know, poke your finger and check your blood all day, you're so brave. And I think, yeah, brave, whatever. I'd like to survive. My goal is to stay out of the hospital, you know. And people say, well, I could never do that. I think, well, what the fuck, you know. If your life depended on it, you would do it. You know, it's not. And so it also kind of depends on the mood you're in. I'm sure you know. Some days you like a little praise, and other days you're like, just leave me alone.
Yeah.
You know. But I think people, we all have that, you know, people kind of backing off and going, oh, my God, you're diseased, you know. And they either feel a little bit scared, like maybe they would somehow get, you know, affected by it. Like, they know it's not contagious, but nevertheless, they're kind of backing up a few feet.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and then the other thing is, like, they give you the whole spiel about, oh, you're so amazing. And you're thinking, you know, what choice do I have? I mean, I want to live, so I got to do what I got to do.
You know, and then for us, the other thing is diabetes is sort of this, you know, twofold disease. Type 2, which is much more common, does have a lot to do with lifestyle factors. And so it's frustrating for the people who have the autoimmune kind to kind of be lumped in with, oh, you brought it on yourself because you ate too much junk food kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's really frustrating. And, you know, we're the kind of innocent victims, if you will. I mean, basically, you know, you get hit with this autoimmune illness and there's just absolutely nothing you can do. And it really had nothing to do with, you know, what you ate in the past. So that's a bit frustrating as well. And just trying to get people to understand, you know, people can actually, you know, if you happen to have a low blood sugar when you're around people who are unfamiliar with diabetes, it can also be life-threatening because people think, oh, my God, you have diabetes, you need insulin. And their first reaction would be like, oh, we got to give this person insulin. And if they did that when you were actually low, they would kill you. So it's also a matter of just making sure you educate people around you to know what to do in case you run into trouble.
So, you know, your whole disease seems extremely food-based and food-responsive, and I'm curious to know whether or not you guys have the whole, like, magical cures thing going on, you know, with cancer. Everybody's just trying to shove a new diet in your face because they think it's going to cure you. Is there any of that going on, too?
Oh, I'm sure we are just as frustrated as you guys with all these. And in particular for diabetes, I mean, there's so much misinformation and all these websites that tease you about how you can reverse your diabetes or, you know, get off insulin if you take this supplement or that supplement, and you really need to be skeptical. You know, and the one thing that we all know is it's carbohydrates. So, yeah, so that's the frustrating thing for us. I mean, you cannot have a piece of, you know, a strawberry or a cracker without thinking about it. You know, it's everything you put in your mouth affects your blood glucose levels. So that's what makes it so much work.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the real truth is that, you know, you need to watch your carb intake, and that's what makes the difference in your blood sugar. And, you know, I would just say to anyone with diabetes, do not be sucked in by all of these ridiculous claims that, you know, this dietary supplement or that, you know, diet is going to change that or make your diabetes go away, especially if it's type 1. Nothing's going to make it go away. Your pancreas is dead, and it's not coming back to life.
Mm-hmm.
Unless they come up with a cure, and that doesn't look too promising right now.
You know, that was my next question about cure. Personally, recently have had to switch my thinking around my cancer from being an acute condition to being chronic. I mean, there's no cure for me. I have these tumors in my neck, and I have just learned that I have to switch my mentality around it, that I am living with cancer in me as an ongoing condition. And I'm curious about what it's like to live with a chronic condition. Do you focus much on research or the idea of a cure?
Well, actually, of course we do, and, you know, the longer you have diabetes, the more jaded you get, the more frustrated, because in the first couple of years, you get super excited when you see all these sensational headlines about a possible cure and a new gene that's been discovered, and it doesn't take long until you realize, like, yada, 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 they've been saying that for years. And
mm-hmm.
I've met people who've had diabetes for, you know, 45 years or more who were running around saying, by the year 2000, you know, they'll have it all figured out, and the year 2000 came and went, and, you know, and so you get very jaded, but, you know, we do hope for a cure. And, you know, one thing that I really appreciate is that, for example, the JDRF, the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, which is one of the big advocacy groups, for years all they did was focus on cure, 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 cure. And finally, the last couple of years, they changed their tune, too, and said, well, let's focus on some research that actually helps people live better with diabetes now.
Mm.
Because this cure thing has taken too long. So they started to fund other projects that had to do with, like, what they call the artificial pancreas, which basically would be the system that would allow people to live a hell of a lot better with the condition they have now, you know. And, of course, we're all still hoping for a cure, but, you know, it's obviously not going to be a magic, you know, it's not going to magically appear anytime soon.
Right. You know, I know one very challenging thing for people who have lived with cancer but are now in remission is the fear of it coming back. And that's one thing that I have to worry about because my cancer's never left me. But I'm curious to know if living with your disease, does it predispose you to having other kinds of health issues or other kinds of diseases that you have to worry about aside from
your diabetes? Well, see, I love talking to people who are in this space because you ask all the right questions. So absolutely. So here's the thing. When your immune system is compromised, very, very often you get other autoimmune illnesses that come with it. So here's what happened to me personally. About 7 weeks after I found out I had diabetes, when I was just, you know, I look like a concentration camp victim. I had lost so much weight, and I was just like a complete mess and a head case and whatever, and I'm having all this, you know, low blood sugars. So I break out in these horrific hives, and I go to see the doctors, and nobody knows what it is, and 6 months later, I'm still, you know, waking up with swollen eyes and swollen neck and, you know, crazy, crazy stuff on my skin, and they said, well, you know, what have you done different? I'm like, well, I'm taking two different kinds of insulin and all these oral pills, and I've totally changed my diet, so it's going to be so hard to figure out what this, you know, what this is. So sure enough, after 6 months of my own research, going to see different doctors and looking on the web to find other patients, it turns out that it's an intolerance to gluten. So many, many people with type 1 also have celiac disease. Somebody mentioned, I see on the on your chat room right now, there's also a lot of us have thyroid illness as well, and it's really funny when I see people talking on the internet about, oh, I have thyroid disease. You know, that to me is such a non-issue. Like, I take a pill, and that's it. I don't even think about that. Like, the diabetes is so much bigger in my life.
Mm-hmm.
But many of us have, again, thyroid disorders, lots of crazy allergies, and intolerance to gluten, things like that, that are, you know, very closely related. And nobody tells you that stuff. I mean, that's a so frustrating thing. It's starting to come out now a bit more, but I just felt like, you know, that's why I started my website. I'm like, I learned all these things, and I bet there are other people out there who are just as frustrated that, you know, the doctors seem to live in their own little box. So the diabetes doctor just deals with diabetes. He didn't know the first thing about allergies, and the allergy doctor didn't know anything about diabetes, so they hadn't actually gotten together and talked about the fact that, you know, you might want to tell this patient that they might have celiac as well.
Well, speaking of autoimmune disorders and other kinds of diseases and overlaps in different diseases, we want to bring Adam on the line and open up the dialogue. Matthew, you want to introduce Adam and bring him into the conversation?
All righty, sure. Here we go. Okay, Adam Sadowski is an entrepreneur who has started 7 companies in design, software, and video games. However, he was just a teenager in 1985 when he was diagnosed with inflammatory bowel disease, specifically ulcerative colitis. In 2003, he began facilitating support groups for children with IBD and their parents, and soon thereafter for young adults as well. In response to growing demand, Adam helped form the nonprofit IBD Support Foundation in 2007, which services now offered in Los Angeles, Chicago, and Miami. I had the privilege of meeting Adam very recently at Cancerpalooza in Los Angeles in May, and it's my pleasure to have him on the show, Adam Sadowski. Hey, Adam.
How you doing, Matt?
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you indeed.
So we are talking about how, regardless of what type of chronic BS you're dealing with, when you're under 40, it kind of really sucks.
Yes.
And
cancer sucks. It really, really sucks.
All right. That's Jack's theme song. So, yeah, I mean, I just met you in May, thanks to the California Cryobank people who put us together, but I'm impressed. I think we're mutually impressed with what we're doing, and I really wanted you to be on the show with Amy because you're some of the two people that I know, A, that I respect, but I think you're bringing messages out there that are very in sync with what I2Y represents, but for different disease verticals. So obviously 15 and diagnosed with ulcerative colitis. Any ideas on how that happened? Is it genetic? Is it environmental? Is there late detection? Like, talk us through that stuff.
Sure. So, okay. So, there's definitely delayed diagnosis for sure. There's no doubt that I was experiencing symptoms, and almost everyone that I've spoken to, and I've had the privilege of speaking to a lot of people with this disease by virtue of my work with the IBD Support Foundation that you mentioned earlier. There's no doubt that almost everyone had symptoms for quite a long time and often had a lot of the sort of crazy experiences that you've described or some of your guests have described on their way to diagnosis. I mean, myself, I was told that I had hemorrhoids and sent home with a bottle of pills. It took me some time before, in fact, even I was diagnosed. So that's absolutely common to this illness. As to sort of what's responsible for it, there's definitely the feeling that there's a genetic component, and there have, in fact, been some of the genes responsible identified. But there's also, it seems, an environmental trigger, something that happens in the environment that sort of sets the disease path off and we don't know what that is. And we think that that may very well be responsible for sort of the recurring flares that will happen with this disease. So there's no doubt that there's an environmental component as well, and we just don't know what that is yet.
And, you know, going back to what Amy was talking about, you know, we're looking at a population of people under 40 that there's so few of us in numbers of what we're dealing with that, I mean, I'm sure, how long did it take you to meet another young adult, you know, dealing with IBD?
That's actually very interesting. When I was handed my diagnosis at 15, I didn't know anyone. I hadn't really heard of it, short of my father, actually, who had it. But I knew no one my age, certainly. And it was really only through involvement with a number of the sort of organizations in the field that I started meeting people. And that was in my 20s before I really started meeting other people who had it, and late 20s at that. So I definitely felt alone and isolated, like I think so many do, upon being handed a diagnosis like this, especially one like IBD, which is, you know, chronically painful, chronically embarrassing, requires, you know, substantial change in lifestyle on a pretty permanent basis. So there's definitely a lot of isolation with the disease, and we see that with a lot of our patients as well.
I'm curious if you can talk about what it was like going through dating and being in your teens and 20s with this disease. I mean, that's something that's so challenging. It was hard for me as a young adult cancer patient being single. Can you talk a bit about that experience?
Absolutely, yeah. Dating and intimacy and all of those things. Well, yeah, I mean, just going back even to high school, I mean, the thing about IBD is that, you know, it's somewhat invisible. You know, you don't necessarily look sick, but you really feel kind of crappy all the time. I sort of liken it to having food poisoning all
the
time.
Can you tell me really briefly what IBD is, in case there are listeners who don't know what that acronym is and what it actually means?
Yeah, okay, so IBD is short for inflammatory bowel disease, and that's two diseases primarily, ulcerative colitis, which is a chronic inflammation of the large intestine, that's sort of the last, I don't know, 5 feet or so, of your intestines. So,
mm-hmm.
The other disease is Crohn's disease, which is the sort of same kind of inflammation, and that can occur pretty much anywhere from the mouth to the anus.
Okay.
And so it's definitely much more complicated in terms of treatment. Ulcerative colitis, which is the one that I had, I like to think that I've beaten it, is treatable through sort of typical drug treatment and so forth, but also you can, in fact, have a surgery to have your large intestine removed, and that alleviates the vast majority of the symptoms. So
okay.
Given the choice between the two, UC is definitely a slightly better diagnosis if you're going to have one.
So back to the dating thing that I so rudely interrupted you on. You were on a great roll.
All right, so intimacy is definitely an issue. But even before intimacy, I can tell you that in high school, I missed so much high school that I was voted most likely not to show up.
Oh.
It definitely is a challenge.
They have awards for that?
They do. They do. In my high school,
I would have competed for that had I known there were awards for it.
Is that right? In any case, certainly it presented a challenge with dating. There's a whole disclosure issue that goes along with it, which is, you know, do I talk about this incredibly embarrassing thing, and at what point do I disclose it? And if I'm on a first date and I don't want to talk about it and I'm having an attack and I'm running to the bathroom with some regularity, that's embarrassing and it's uncomfortable and it definitely
mm-hmm.
creates issues. There's certainly body image issues associated with this, especially if you've had surgeries, which, of course, leave, you know, significant scars and sometimes even, you know, external appliances like ostomies or things like that. So extended hospital stays can interrupt, you know, the flow of a natural dating progression. And those things, even though in many cases they're not actually problems, certainly play with your head that they will be. And so that's a huge self-esteem blow and self-confidence, and big issues all.
So we're keeping Amy on the line, too, because I think the two of you bring so much to the table from two different perspectives. But I just had one sort of ignorant question. Whether it's genetic or environmental or diet-based, is there any relationship between, you know, IBD and diabetes? Can one influence the other?
Well, I'm sure that, I mean, I'm just speaking a little bit out of turn, but I'm sure that diabetes makes just about everything worse.
It does. Actually, the more common thing with diabetes is something called gastroparesis, which basically is a form of neuropathy where your intestines become, like, neuropathy is basically they sort of get petrified. So your intestines are sort of inactive and they don't work right, and essentially your stomach doesn't empty properly, and it causes all kinds of problems, and it makes it so much harder to manage your diabetes because the food that's in your system is not being processed at the normal rate, it's hard to match up your insulin to the amount of carbs, but it also causes obviously problems with going to the restroom a lot and, just really uncomfortable, embarrassing. So similar, I guess, in the sense of lifestyle. So ugly stuff can happen. Let's put it that way.
So I'm curious about you two who don't have cancer. Let's face it, cancer is like the glamour queen of the disease world. I mean, I don't think anybody is making headlines because, Christina Applegate was just diagnosed with IBD. I mean, that just doesn't happen. Do you ever get miffed that, cancer hogs the disease spotlight?
So well, to be honest. Actually, there have been a lot of reports coming out about how, diabetes is so, low on the priority list, which is so ridiculous because it's such an enormous, enormous cost burden on the healthcare system in this country and such an epidemic. But, in our case, I have to say there are more and more celebrities coming out of the closet with their diabetes lately, including Nick Jonas, who's been a lot in the headlines, who's actually at this Children's Congress on Washington Mall today with a group that's doing advocacy efforts for diabetes. So, and you have Delta Burke, and you have...
Yeah, but see, nobody was reporting about him because of the whole tobacco thing. See, we still are going to
get
it again.
Nobody cares
about
the Jonas Brothers.
They end up in the shadow somehow. You're right. I mean, cancer gets...
We updated you.
Wait 10 minutes, they'll be gone.
There's a problem, you guys. It's acute, not chronic. And there's also, as I mentioned earlier, the stigma with diabetes that, fat people get that because they don't take care of themselves, for people who are unfamiliar with it. So, yeah, it's a bit frustrating, when we know what a big problem it is, just trying to get attention. And, the groups, the advocacy groups have been super active on Capitol Hill, and yet the headlines always seem to be about other things.
Yeah.
I would echo that as well and say that IBD is probably even less admitted to in the celebrity world. And there have been some cases. I live in Los Angeles. The hospitals that I'm affiliated with, we certainly see our share of celebrities. The word gets out a little bit when a celebrity is in, and if they're in with IBD, typically it's announced that it's an eating disorder or a surgery or something totally unrelated. Because
so much for HIPAA, right?
Right.
Yeah. Well,
I wonder if any Victoria's Secret models have IBD.
Well, didn't Farrah Fawcett ended up with anal cancer?
She did indeed. Yeah, she did indeed.
Mm-hmm. So at least they were honest about that.
That's true. No, that's absolutely right. And but of course, that was cancer.
It's also good that a celebrity with
to see
a different
your name
type of
headlines.
Kid.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Because usually you only hear about the celebrities with breast cancer and stuff. It's good to hear a different type of cancer get represented.
I want to, Amy, if you could talk just briefly about the diabetesmine.com. First of all, I'd like to know where you got the name from, but I also want to point out that, it represents sort of we talk about health 2.0 as the evolution of, social media, social networking, user-generated content in healthcare. And there's been such a bubble in the last 2 years of all these organizations getting all this funding and failing miserably, but you're still chugging along and you guys are doing amazing stuff. And how do you figure, what do you attribute your success to, and what do you really think the value that your website brings to people is?
Oh, that's so sweet. Well, honestly, after I learned about you and what you're doing, I thought, why didn't I call it diabetessucks.com?
Right.
It would have been a much better name. But actually, the idea was this play on words, diabetes mine, I'm stuck with it. It's mine now. And the idea of it being sort of a gold mine of informational nuggets for other people who, when I started the site back in the dawn of blogging, late 2004, I was desperately looking for other people who are, I didn't want the Mayo Clinic and, all these very canned, institutional websites. I wanted to find some real people who are actually living with this thing and just ask them all the logistical questions, you know, where do you carry your insulin, and, you know, what do you do with these used syringes and all of these things? And it was so difficult to find real people at that time. So that was really the inspiration for me was, okay, I kind of have a journalism background. I did it as a hobby. I thought it would be kind of fun. And I was so amazed at how quickly so many people found me and started to respond and were just, you know, so grateful to find someone who was just talking at a very, you know, baseline level about this is what it's like and this is what sucks and, you know, I read this article and this is what I think about it kind of thing. And it just grew. And I was actually featured in the Wall Street Journal early on, about 4 months after I started the site, in this story about patient blogging, which, again, back then was sort of this revolutionary, crazy thing that people with some kind of illness would actually be, you know, honest and blog about it in a public sphere like that. And all around me now, it was in the last years, this huge blogging community has grown up. There are probably about 800 diabetes blogs now, I would guess. I mean, there's new ones popping up every day. And there are so many new social networks all the time, too. And I'm actually also the community manager of a new site called DiabeticConnect.com, which actually attracts a lot of type 2 diabetics. But it's a great, great place for people who are, you know, who just have never had connection with other real people living with this illness. And people are just so grateful. So, you know, I just feel like I kind of landed in the middle of this Health 2.0 stuff. And it worked out really nicely for me because I'm a kind of a tech geek and I used to write about technology. So diabetes uses obviously a lot of devices and software. People use a lot of programs so they can, you know, evaluate their glucose levels and look at them in charts and that kind of thing. So those are the kind of things that interest me. And they're building new devices all the time for, you know, improved insulin delivery. So my site is kind of a mix of reporting about all of those advancements, research, products, book reviews, and then just me kind of sounding off about how I feel about living with this illness. And it's been a wild ride, and it's been wonderful. And I've met some of the most amazing people who I know I would never have come across if I hadn't have ended up with this crazy disease.
Well, they call us crazy people patient opinion leaders, and apparently we have some credibility these days.
We actually matter. And so here's the interesting thing. Now the other side of what I do is I run a small consultancy with my husband, and we are working with some companies that that are actually working on new diabetes devices and some pharma companies doing kind of consulting with them about, okay, what does the patient community care about? What do they think about? How can they get involved in social media in a way that is actually adding value and not making people feel exploited? You know, and those are very timely topics, and they're not easy to answer some of those questions. So it's a ton of fun, and I feel like, you know, that's some way that I can sort of help my fellow patients. Everyone tries to do what they can, and that's my thing is sort of information and, you know, trying to be that kind of liaison between the patient community and the industry.
And, Adam, your website is still en route to becoming something like that. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. No, we're definitely, yes. We're not there yet, but we're definitely, we have big plans for sure.
And rightfully so. I mean, there's such an amazing community. I think, I mean, and I'll let you each chime in on this question, but, you know, one of the things that I found from an anthropology perspective about what I2Y has done in this country is a lot of people are like, finally, someplace I can go where I don't feel stigmatized, that makes me feel like what I'm going through isn't for nothing, and that, you know, it's about time that I was able to be in a community that understood me and that I had a voice.
That's right.
And it seems to me like, you know, it could be, I mean, for sake of just rhetoric, I'm too young for this for IBD, and I'm too young for this for diabetes, that you're fostering these amazingly activist communities of people that are finally saying, you know, I won't stand for this anymore.
That's right. That's right.
That's right. And, you know, in the case of diabetes, I mean, it's a billion-dollar industry, and I think we have this kind of love-hate relationship with the pharma industry because, you know, the medicines they make and the devices they make keep us alive. But on the other hand, we feel very exploited by the high cost of glucose test strips, you know, the crazy marketing, the amount of money that's thrown at drug advertising. So, you know, it's a tricky relationship. And I think that there's actually a conspiracy theory that the industry really is not even looking for a cure because they have no interest in finding one.
Hmm.
Conspiracy.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah. I want to do a whole show. I want to do a whole show on
You should do a whole show on that. It's
on that,
you,
yeah, because, I mean, I think that there is, I think that when we talk about these things, it can sort of start to sound like whacked out conspiracy theory. However, I think that, you know, it is really important to look at these industry connections and what is and is not being done to help us, and that, you know, there's a lot of validity to these conversations, and they're important ones to have, especially because I think as patients, we're consumers, you know, and we need to figure out how we can take power, which is, I believe, you know, through political power. And I'm kind of curious about whether or not each of you and the different diseases you deal with, is there any kind of policy arm who's advocating for you on Capitol Hill? And is that something that's discussed very much amongst patients?
Well, there is for IBD, and I've participated in some things where I've gone to Washington and, you know, knocked on congressman's door to try to get co-sponsorship on an IBD bill. That was a couple, 3 years ago. And, you know, it definitely is a path for us. And, you know, just trying to get money for research is the big thing, because I think if we can start to understand a little bit of the environmental trigger, I think that 'll actually explain a lot of the onset of various diseases, not just IBD. Because I think that the action here is not unique to IBD. I think whatever mechanism is sort of kicking that on is probably common to other diseases, and I think it'll be very valuable in the long run for us to discover.
Yeah, in the case, I would say in the case of diabetes, so you have two big, you know, major advocacy organizations in this country. It's the American Diabetes Association, the ADA, and then the one I mentioned earlier, the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, JDRF. And even though ADA is, you know, ginormous, they've been somewhat criticized for being kind of, you know, in cahoots with the industry because they have close ties, and they do some advocacy efforts, but I think the louder voice that goes and does kind of the kind of shake it up stuff is definitely JDRF. And as I said, they're doing the Children's Congress right now. They have been very active on Capitol Hill. But, you know, one of the things that I have pushed for personally on my site is that, you know, it was still very geared towards children when I came around, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. And I kept saying, you know, what happens to all these type 1s when you graduate, quote unquote, right? So you hit 18 or 20, you still have type 1 diabetes. You still have a whole life ahead of you. And then there's all of us who get diagnosed later. And we felt like, you know, you go to the website and it didn't feel like a home for, you know, for young adults. So I really pushed them to include the adult population living with type 1. And they've embraced that. They actually started a new social network for young adults called juvenation.org, and they've been, you know, getting better about including the rest of the population. But, you know, that is a big issue, I think, is, you know, pushing for legislation. In our case, it's, you know, the American Disabilities Act amendment made a big difference also, so that people who had needed certain accommodations at work were not going to get, you know, booted out because their diabetes was somehow interfering supposedly with their ability to do their jobs. And you guys probably read all the headlines about Sotomayor and her diabetes and the ridiculous claims people were making about how, you know, she might not be eligible because her life might be cut short when,
right.
You know, when, in fact, I mean, she's been living very well with this illness for, you know, many, many years and performing her job, and it's much more likely that someone without type 1 would have, you know, would keel over if something else, because you have to be so on your health when you have type 1 diabetes.
Well, that's interesting.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you guys are fantastic guests, and we thank you so much for being on the show. I think it's so important that we bust out of our cozy cancer nest and, you know, start talking to other people with other kinds of diseases. And I think partially it's really important because of the political power issue, and that we have so much more leverage as young adults dealing with health insurance and other issues that kind of go across the board, regardless of what disease you have, if we work together and collaborate.
For sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, there's some stats about, I think, upwards of 40 million Americans are living with chronic illnesses, and they're in the workplace. And, you know, the whole idea is that we're all kind of in these little silos of our own illness.
Mm-hmm.
And if we all kind of banded together and, you know, we're able to come, you know, advocate for what we want in terms of healthcare reform and whatnot, that would be very powerful.
The All Young Adult Diseases Suck Coalition.
Oh, very good. I love that, Matthew.
What's the acronym for that?
AYADS.
Hey, IADS.
Oh, no, A-Y-A-D-C. A-Y-A-D-C.
Iadic.
No, wait, I'm messing up my all young adult disease. A-Y-A-D-S. AIDS. There we go. Sounds like its own disease. I have AIDS.
Sounds like an exclamation you would make.
Right.
Yay.
Well, we're definitely going to have you guys back. We ran over for good measure. It was a great show. And, again, we could have you on and not even do an opening segment or news and just talk for 2 hours. I think you guys bring so much to the table. And tell us your websites just as we go out. Amy?
Diabetesmind.com.
And
Adam?
IBDSF.com. All righty. Well, thank you both for being on the show. Good luck with everything, and we'll definitely be in touch.
Thank you all.
So much.
Okay, Amy Tendridge and Adam Sadowski. And that wraps our show tonight. Jack and Carol, you got plans this week?
Yeah.
No, you don't. Carol, you have plans this week?
What do I ever do but sit and write and blog? No.
That's true.
No, actually, I do have plans this week. I'm going on vacation to Detroit.
Is that... Wait a minute. I don't... No one goes on vacation to Detroit.
I am going on vacation...
Can I buy some property?
Yeah, I have $10 in my back pocket. That's all you need these days. I have a friend who's a photographer, and she takes incredible pictures of dilapidated buildings, and what better place to go but Detroit. So we're going to go hang out in Detroit. I'm kind of excited about it.
You realize we just lost the 4 people who listen from Detroit, right?
They have internet in Detroit?
Oh, stop. Let's not bust
They live Detroit. In the burbs. Don't worry.
Michael Moore is no longer a fan on Facebook. Okay.
Yeah. I'm going to OHIO this weekend.
You are?
I am.
Why?
Because I want to.
Okay.
I actually have a wedding to go to.
It's nice to not have things
And you
to
know
do.
What? You know what I love about weddings? None of them are mine.
There you go.
All right.
All right. Well, you two have a wonderful week, and we'll recap next week for the show. And
Good stuff.
Really, really good show. Hope everyone out there in listener land
a lot of new listeners
enjoyed
tonight.
Our conversation tonight. This is what we're about, folks. Thank you so much. And now it's time for our closing sequence.
Prepare to activate.
I hear there's rumors on the internets.
You ever seen a grown man naked?
And so, to all of you, a fond farewell.
Hooray, I'm helping.
You are a meathead.
Oh, Magoo, you've done it again.
That was so terrible, I think you gave me cancer.
All right, folks, that's tonight's show. I hope you had as much fun as we did poking a stick at stupid cancer.
Love.
I'd like to thank our guests, Yosef Eliezeri, Amy Tendridge from Diabetes Mind, and Adam Sadowski from the IBDF Foundation. Next week, continuing our online theme, Uber Guru Healthcare Bloggers, Wendy Harpum, MD, Healthcare Blogger, and Jane Sarenson Khan, Health Economist, founder of Think Health and the blogger of Health Populi, two brilliant minds in the health blogging space. Sure to be a hell of a show. Same bat time, same bat channel. Folks, remember, if you've missed any of our previous shows, listen to the archives at stupidcancershow.com or subscribe to our podcast at itunes.ituy.com. Remember, if it's not stupid, it's not cancer. We'll see you all back here next week, my friends, live from the chemo deck. Jack, Carol, Captain Stuke, and I wish you a great evening, and a special thanks to our live studio audience, Tessa, Eric, Lisa Wolf, and then Yosef Eliezeri, who was our Survivor Spotlight. All righty, folks, have a great evening. Go to bed, Leah. Fokker out.